being able to speak to everyone, hear what they're saying. It might not seem like it's a big deal to you, but it's probably a big deal to them. So it's just hearing what they have to say and just trying to come to like a common ground or try and solve the problem together instead of butting heads and being like, and making it an argument and just solving it together, I think.
I think that's right on the money. I think production's one of the places that when it's done well can be a departmental therapist. Welcome to Filmmaking Frame, the show where we interview industry professionals to find out the tricks and secrets behind the silver screen. With us, as always, is my co-host,
Tom Dexter,
and myself, Daniel Hughes.
Today, we are with rising talent in the world of film and television production office, Mike Saxon. Mike started as a production trainee on His Dark Materials in Cardiff before, and now works as an assistant production coordinator with recent credits including The Marvels and Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. Hello, Mike.
Hello, lovely to be here.
So, Mike, we always like to start this podcast with asking our guest a bit about what your role is and how your department is kind of structured and how it fits into sort of the general ecosystem of the film industry.
So my role is I'm an assistant production coordinator, sometimes abbreviated to APOC. It's sort of a mid-tier role in the production office. Tend to work quite closely with the coordinator themselves. Production as a whole, it's sort of like you deal with a lot of logistics and paperwork and admin. You're there to basically organize the shoot and any problems that might arise. Yeah, you're very much like the central point and you're like a service department and you help all the other departments be able to do their job.
And pretty much every department will speak to production.
Because yeah, everything goes through.
You cover things as much as like how people are paid. Mm-hmm. All the way through to how they get their kit and how they turn up. And you're literally running everything.
Yes, essentially. I don't want to pick it up too much. But
What does a kind of standard week look like for you? So what kind of tasks fall on your desk as APOC?
That's the fun thing about being an APOC, actually, is that job to job, your role can change quite drastically. So if you're a prod sec, which is a secretary, which is the role lower down, or one below APOC, I should say. Your day would be purely like doing crew contracts and a lot of file distribution and admin and paperwork and things like that. Whereas being an APOC, you're across anything your coordinator doesn't want to be across, essentially. So it can change a lot job to job. A lot of times there's a dedicated travel and accommodation coordinator and that falls under that remit.
Very good people to get to like you, I can assure
you. Yes, you get the good hotel rooms that way.
Yeah. And very bad people to myself.
Yeah, you essentially cover the things that a coordinator has not enough time to do because they are, you know, they work tirelessly and it's one of the most thankless jobs in the industry, being a coordinator. And so it can vary from job to job. And you do like a lot of like cast contracts and dealing with like vendors, and sometimes you get some things from the production manager's plate, like doing tech POs and ordering plant and stuff like that.
So it's very much the assistant part of assistant production coordinator is you're assisting the production coordinator.
Absolutely,
so whatever they need.
Yeah.
Could you briefly sort of explain, okay, so you're coming into the industry, you start as a production trainee, what a few tasks a production trainee does, how does that differ from a production secretary, assistant production coordinator, and what's the difference between a production coordinator and production manager? And I get it will change job from job, but roughly.
Obviously, it will change job to job because some production managers and coordinators have different ideas of like how they feel the office should be structured because whatever works for them might not work for someone else. But production runner or trainee or assistant or whatever, you know, they want to be called will often be on their feet quite a lot. It's quite a lot of just general office assisting. So, you know, making sure kitchen's stocked, people have hot drinks, stationery's been ordered, printers are all working. Often, you know, they become a bit of a printer assistant and not a production assistant. And also it's just a good way to see the industry as a whole as well, because you're so involved with every other department. So you get to see what they do, and often, you know, people like talking about their own job. So if, you know, you get chummy with someone in art department or camera or makeup and say, oh, how does that work? And they'll often just sit down and show you. So it's a really good way to see how the rest of the industry works.
Do you see production trainees, runners then going into those departments if they like it?
Yes, quite a lot.
So it's a good department for juniors to go into to experience and then also form connections in order to make the transition.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And then so you've worked as a production runner for a period of time and then you get enough experience and then you jump up to production secretary. Is that the next step?
Yes. So often you'll be a production assistant I was a production assistant for two and a bit years with COVID in the middle of it. And you'll do a lot of the office assistant-y sort of running around, fetching lunches, getting drinks, making sure meeting rooms are ready for meetings. But often your coordinator will can you be across this? And it's a bit more admin-y, a bit more, desk-based. And it's sort of just building that up and building up the knowledge and then, making a bit of a jump to production secretary.
And what's a production secretary's day-to-day look like?
It's a lot of crew onboarding. So obviously production tend to be first ones through the door with accounts and locations, as you know. All the crew need to be onboarded and that's, adding them to distribution software and getting their contracts done and sending them scripts and NDAs and things like that. So it's a lot of admin and it can be quite tedious, but I always really enjoyed it because I'm a sucker for a spreadsheet. But.
I've seen it described as when you make a film, it's essentially like launching a business, running that business, building a massive department, a massive team. So you end up being a company with hundreds of employees and then shutting it all down again in the space of weeks or months.
Yes.
So if you imagine, for listeners, if you imagine that there is nothing, nothing exists, then someone eventually hires a production manager who then builds a team and it's all built from scratch. Every process, buying a fridge for the office, buying pencils, pens, like you say, everything from scratch right through. And then I assume after the job, getting rid of all the stuff.
Yeah, which is the beauty of wrap. But the beauty and the awfulness of wrap is then packing it all the way. It's almost like cleaning up after the party and everyone's left and you're just there with a dustpan and brush.
I'm part of a production online group on Facebook. And I do have to say it's quite good that a lot of productions will say, hey, just finished up a job. Here's a list of stuff we've got.
Yes.
And jobs that are just starting up go, oh, I'll grab that.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's quite environmental.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is getting better with that. Mm. People like posting their asset lists and then poaching stuff because everyone always needs a mini fridge or a microwave or a kettle or something.
Can you give some examples of those Facebook groups?
The only really big one that I'm in is Production Rabble, which is, I think anyone who works in production knows of it.
So if you're wanting to, make a short film or whatever audience where you are looking for free props, that's a good one to join because often you're not looking to get the value of the item, you just want it picked up and gone.
Yes.
So you do sometimes sell items. It's especially smaller films will sell them to recoup their budget. Yeah.
Yeah, had that once before on a job where they had a props and asset sale at the end.
Would you agree that the larger the project is, the more valuable stuff they're willing to just give away to get it done?
I guess,
do you think it's like a U-curve where the really big budget have the money to pay people to sort stuff?
Yeah, often with big studio stuff, they'll have an assets person. And it's like, well, we might need this somewhere down the line, so it's all going to go into storage. Mm. Or they'll just have another production going straight in after. So it's everything can just stay in place because the new production is going to take it all over.
So because these big studios are now paying for spaces in UK studios. So one company will have Pinewood, another company will have Shepperton. And so they're there and every production is there. So they can just keep moving things through.
Yeah.
Important question. Do production people take some of the office plants home at the end of a job?
Often, yes.
Would it be fair to say that as a location manager, you will never run out of bin bags or cable ties as a production coordinator, your equivalent is?
Yeah, and extension leads. Yeah, extension leads.
If you need small sundry items, work in film.
Yeah. End up with too many.
I think in Daniel acquired a sofa from a green room.
I did. I acquired Hugh Jackman's sofa from The Sun.
oh my God, you could flog that on eBay for tens of pounds.
Yeah, there's no verification on it.
You needed to get a selfie with Hugh on the sofa.
Yeah.
Amazing. So that gives us a rough idea about the department.
Mm-hmm.
What was your entry point? So I guess going back, when did you decide that you wanted to work in film? What decisions did you make? Was it as a teenager? And I guess, what was your first steps?
I didn't even think about it as a career because I grew up in, you know, quite a small village. Thought, oh, you know, filmmaking's, you know, done in Los Angeles. And didn't think of it as a career really until going to university. Yeah, went to university and joined the film society and thought, oh, it's just going to be, we're going to go to cinema and then go to the pub and talk about the film. And was quite happy with that. And then sat down on like the first like social and they were talking about like, what films we're going to make this term. And I was like, we're going to make films? I mean, it was just a bunch of us running around with a camera making very amateur stuff. But through that, realized there was an industry in the UK and in Cardiff especially, which is where I went to university, and then started to think of it more as a career. So yeah, finished my degree and thought, no, this is what I want to do. Gave myself a deadline. I was like, well, if I don't have a job in film and TV by the time I'm 25, I'll try and get a real job, like a grown-up job. And so I worked part-time at a supermarket for a year and a half, I think, while emailing literally anyone I could, like, and applying for anything that I saw on the internet. And eventually I'd heard that there was a production office or a production company starting up in Cardiff. I went on their webpage and spammed the contact us section for 6 months straight. That I had a notes page on my laptop and I'd copy and paste the email into the email, like little email box, and sent email to them every single day for 6 months to no avail. And then I think another 6 months went by and eventually someone emailed me and said, hey, I've just looked at our inbox and we've got like 90 emails from you. Are you still interested in work? And I was like, yes, absolutely. And she was like, well, we don't have anything now, but...
Stop emailing us. We'll give you something when we can.
Exactly. They're like, can I keep your contact details and email you at some point in the future if you've got work experience? I said, absolutely. And then another period of time passed and they got back to me and said, look, we've got some opportunities for work experience coming up. What are your areas of interest? And I didn't think I'd get that far, so I hadn't thought about it. I was like, well, which departments
can I work in?
Yeah, which departments do you offer work experience in? And they were like, production. And I was like, oh, that sounds good.
You had me at, would you like to work?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well, I don't have any like skills.
Yeah.
And I could do like admin and spreadsheets and logistics and stuff. So that sounds pretty good to me.
How were you at making a cup of tea and Gora coffee?
Coffee, I had to be taught. I'm not a coffee drinker. So my first day, someone asked for like a cafetiere of coffee. And I was like, I don't know what that is. Where do I put it?
For all the juniors out here, it is surprisingly employable if you can make your bosses a good cup of coffee or tea.
Any form, an espresso machine, a cafetiere or an AeroPress or an instant.
I'm not a coffee drinker either, but I benefited from, I worked at Costa Coffee as a teenager.
Oh, there you go.
So I know how to make it, even though I don't like it.
So yeah, that went a long way. And then they said, do you want to come for a week of work experience in a production office? And I said, can I do two? And they said, sure. And they were like, oh, just by the way, this is for Welsh residents only because it's through a Welsh scheme. And I was like, yeah, I'm a Welsh resident. And they're like, oh, well, can we have you?
Did you have to put on a Welsh accent?
Well, this was all over email. And yeah, did 2 weeks. Absolutely loved it. Loved the energy. And I was like, yeah, I really want to do this. And I was very lucky to be asked back as a full-time production staff member on the second series of that TV show, which was His Dark Materials.
Amazing. So presumably you went to university at the age that a lot of people do, 18, 19?
Yeah.
So when you said you, given it till you were 25, you gave yourself 4 years.
Yeah, I was 21 when I graduated. And I think I worked at a supermarket for a year and a half. So. Yeah.
You're about halfway through your time.
Yeah, scale. I was 22 when I was offered the job and 23 when I started.
So I have a question for you that I'm sure a lot of listeners that are in their teens and are thinking about maybe doing something like this, or they've heard this podcast and now they're thinking about it. What was your degree, and would you say it had relevance to what you've ended up doing, or what were the perks of doing that degree?
I went to uni to do physics, which had absolutely no relevancy whatsoever. I mean, there's a lot of problem solving involved, but mostly it showed me that I didn't want to do that. I spent most of my second and third years not doing my degree and, you know, running around with the Film Society making short films. But I did stick it out. There was a point where I was like, I might drop out and try and pursue film, and was persuaded not to, and was told to stick it out because, yeah, you don't need a film degree to go into film, but, you know, it's pretty good to have a backup because it's a competitive industry to get into.
I suppose I'm interested, who convinced you to stay? I guess if it's your family, what were your family's thoughts on?
It was my family who convinced me to stay on it, but they were never not supportive. When I said I wanted to go and film, they were like, okay, that's pretty good. You've got a fallback. You've got a part-time job, so there's money coming in. And yeah, I think they knew that I really wanted to do it.
And do they have any connections to the creative industries?
None whatsoever. No.
What sort of fields were they in?
My mum had they're going to listen to this. my mum worked at a library and then a care company. She was a full-time carer. And my dad was a trading standards officer for 30 years. Yeah.
So something I always find interesting when I talk to people who are in this industry is, do your parents or siblings or family understand what you do?
Absolutely not. No. Definitely not at first, because I'd always get comments like, oh, so you're on set, aren't you? Almost like trying to convince themselves. And I'd be like, no, I'm not on set at all. And like, oh, so what do you do then when you're not filming? And I'm like, well, I do my job. I think they're starting to get it now. I was on a TV show a couple of years ago and we filmed in Scotland and I was doing the travel accommodation for it. And I stopped off at my parents' place on the way home and I was just flooded with emails. So I set up on the dining room table for like a couple of hours before heading off again. And my mom just came to the door and watched me for like 10 minutes before I noticed. And I was like, what are you doing? She was like, well, I don't know what you do. So I wanted to watch.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is it. And I think they started to get it then. And from then on, they've just, yeah, they've been supportive. And even through the strikes, they were supportive.
I suppose from your dad's perspective, if you're trading standards, sometimes you're in the office.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're doing an inspection.
Yes.
So sometimes you're in the office in production. Sometimes you're popping onto set to hand someone something.
Exactly. Yeah. I think they do grasp it now, but yeah.
What qualities did the best boss you've ever had have?
Probably just diplomacy. Just being able to speak to everyone, hear what they're saying. It might not seem like it's a big deal to you, but it's probably a big deal to them. So it's just hearing what they have to say and just trying to come to like a common ground or try and solve the problem together instead of butting heads and being like, and making it an argument and just solving it together, I think.
I think that's right on the money. I think production's one of the places that when it's done well can be a departmental therapist.
Yes, you're like the agony aunt to everyone.
I suppose when it's done badly, you have everyone's ire, where they're basically like, production won't allow me to do this, or production won't allow me to do this.
Yeah, and then... I'm sure there's some of that even if it's done well, because I think everyone wants like a common enemy to like run. And I think production sometimes...
Production doesn't spend a ton of time on set, so all the set departments can get together and go, you know who has not allowed us?
Exactly. Do you know who said no to me today?
Yeah. It's that Mike again.
Yeah, exactly. It's...
You know who didn't put me in the penthouse suite again?
but it's resource delegation, essentially. Yeah. So, I mean, I just watched the live action Avatar, and I remember one of the characters said he had to decide between whether to give rations to the soldiers or to the orphanage, because he's only got one lot of food. And that's an extreme example, because no one's starving on a set, hopefully, if all things go well.
If the catering's good.
If the catering's good. But it's essentially resource delegation and deciding, okay, you've got so much budget, so if you say yes to every department's demand, you will run out of money before you finish the job.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm kind of interested, for my own personal knowledge, and I'm sure someone will learn from it. So how much control does the production manager have over budget, or do they deal with a line producer on an ongoing basis?
It will depend from job to job, because sometimes, well, film mostly doesn't have a line producer. It's a unit production manager, which is like a TV PM and a TV line producer molded into one. So they'll have a lot of control over budget, but then again, it will come from, you know, the producer and the studio, often if it is a studio film. But as far as like resource delegation, I think it's mostly set out from the onset when, you know, a studio exec or studio.
On the initial budget.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be initial budget. And that will come from the script breakdown of like, oh, is this going to be VFX heavy? Is this going to be, have we got a lot of like crowd or anything like that?
So there's never a point where you as a production team would be like, we don't know whether we can say yes or no because we don't have the info about the budget.
No, if someone would come to me with that sort of thing, it would be a, sorry, this is above my pay grade. You'll have to, this is a PM question.
I think there would be times when that is true for the PM, and it would be when they're waiting for departmental budgets to come in. So for example, I've been once where I took over another job and the person I took over from hadn't kept an up-to-date budget, so I had to kind of sort through the wreckage to work out.
And when you say budget, you're talking about actual spend, or you're talking about anticipated spend?
Both. Because sometimes...
So in a way, it's a ledger of where you're at.
Yeah, so it's... Because some things it's like, you only know once a plan has been decided. So for example, if you're waiting for script changes, it'll be like, well, if it stays a castle, I will spend about this much. If, however, we downgrade it, then I can save it here. Or, for example, on a recent show I worked on, if we filmed in Whitechapel, it was going to cost £6,000. And if we filmed it in Greenwich Naval College, it was going to cost £72,000. And so it's like that has a massive impact on... And it was the director and the producers were debating. So the PM, I'm sure, had things that which way that went had a big impact, and that was just us, let alone the cranes that it would have meant for Sparks. And
yeah,
so if it's a film, because I've trained more as a producer in film, you would hopefully build a budget where you've got pockets of cash, and then it'd be a case of if there's extraordinary demands somewhere that were unanticipated demands, you would be like, do I take some resource there? So do I cut one day of shooting and then therefore have free up some cash for a crane or the Naval College? Which, so it's a fluid thing, presumably, and you as an APOC just adjust as you go.
Yeah, you have to sort of, you know, adjust on the fly.
And one thing I will say, film on the whole tends to be pretty good at is zones of responsibility being fluid but delineated, in that it's like I can come to you and go, can you give me an answer on this? And you're like, no, this is something I have to go speak to X about. And that's fairly common, that it's like, it's okay for you not to be able to give an answer to something.
Yeah, I think the sentence I say most on a weekly basis is, I don't know, but I'll find out for you.
It's a good answer. It's better than pretending you know.
Yeah, like,
and then
just giving like a wrong answer.
Yeah. Or not replying to emails if it's done via email.
Yeah.
That's something that I find really frustrating is when you're, sometimes you just want to, I don't know, I'll find out.
Yeah.
But if they just don't answer because they're trying to find out, then you're sat there going, well, did they get the email? Or
yeah, exactly.
Can I make
a decision? Production is like a service department often, you know, like the camera trainee won't know what every single person in the production office is across. So they'll just know, they might just know the runner because they've seen them. So they'll email the runner and be like, hey, this might not be you, but I've got a question. And then it's your job to, you know,
field that.
Like, I don't know, but my colleague does, so CC them in.
And I'm curious if you agree, but I think on the whole, it's better to contact more junior than and give the answer than go the other way and contact a more senior person that needs to answer.
Yeah, I'd always err on the side of don't flood the PM's inbox.
Dear PM, I've run out of pens.
Yeah, exactly. Like, bother the runner and then the runner can
put it in the right direction.
Exactly. Yeah. Or they can just speak to the PM. Time that's, you know,
and it can be that the a production coordinator has a meeting with the PM and is like, here's the 20 questions I need to ask you.
Yes.
And they can do like knock that out in one hit and clear the decks.
Yeah. Often that's will depend on like the PMs and the coordinators' relationship. If they're quite close, because often, you know, you work with the same people, it might just be that they're sat 5 yards apart and there's a constant dialogue.
Yeah.
Often it would be the, like you said, the coordinator will just like field a lot of the questions and then decide which ones are important enough to go higher up the chain.
Have you seen that dynamic where it's not working between a production coordinator and a PM?
Yes, but only in a way where the two people were professional enough to make it work.
Yeah, so just didn't get on, but they stayed.
Yeah, I mean, you're spending 10 plus hours a day with someone 5 days a week. At some point, you're not going to get on.
And you're tired.
And you're tired and you're overworked and stressed. But
and not to discourage anyone from working in production, but you guys don't tend to get overtime for the long hours you do.
Again, that depends on like the size of the job. Been on smaller jobs where it's made clear to you from the start, like, look, really sorry, we don't have a massive overtime budget. We'll try and give you some here and there, but we're also going to try and get you out on time every day. It's like we're aware, like, or if you're coming up to your 10 or 11 hours, we're going to try and get you out and stagger shifts and things like that to avoid ever going into overtime. And that is something that I have noticed getting better over the last few years. Post-COVID, everyone's very much more, look, this can get made without us breaking our backs.
So do you find that during the prep period that you get a bit more slack so you can finish a bit earlier, or is it you're busy all the time?
It definitely depends on how close to the shoot you are. So if you're in like prep minus 10, which is if you're 10 weeks out from shoot, often, if it's a Friday and it's like 4 o'clock and it's quite quiet, you'll, you know, take advantage of that and leave a bit earlier. But yeah, in anything like leading up to the shoot, you tend to be pretty busy.
I'm curious, what are the biggest perks about working in production?
You hear the most gossip.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, you're aware of every other department. Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, you hear the most gossip. And also, I think a more serious answer is you see the production at every stage. So you see everyone starting, you get to know everyone, you see it all take shape, and then you see the entire shootout, and then you see wrap at the end as well. So it's interesting from that perspective.
It's so interesting because I've seen the opposite, because I've worked on a lot of sets as a dailies, which is where you're not contracted for the whole job. You just come in when you're needed. And I will come in and I won't know anyone or anything or what the job's called or who's in it or where we are. Yeah. On those sort of things, you just come in and you work and you do what you know what you to do.
If you forgive me, my second ever job was as a dailies location assistant on Black Mirror. And the code name of the job was, I think, Black Dog.
Yeah.
And it was one day at Longcross Studios. And the location manager put me there. It was basically like, tell people when they come this way for Black Mirror, keep going that way. And I was like, cool, I can do that. And then in the 4 hours I was there, not a single person from Black Mirror came, but lots of people from Black Dog came, but no one had told me the code name. So I kept having people go, is it that way to Black Dog? I'm like, I assume Black Mirror's that way. But they're like, oh, that'll be fine. I'm like, for 4 hours, I was like, I called the location manager. I was like, not a single person has arrived.
Amazing.
The first AD's on set, like, we're really quiet today. We've got like 20 people here.
And she was like, no, it's fine. I'm like, because I had that cool, like, it was only when I got to see her, because she was dealing with receiving them at the other side, that she was like, why did you think no one was coming? Because people, like, were you just not paying down? I was like, so.
I remember my first ever job. I pulled up with my car, literally my first day on my first ever job. And the security guard said, oh, you're here for Will? You know, and I was like, yeah. But really, he shouldn't be telling me what the job is.
No, he's supposed to ask.
Yeah.
Otherwise, then you just say yes and then you're in then. Yeah.
But that's something that if people aren't aware of, listeners, is that most jobs that we work on have code names. Mm-hmm. So they won't, you know.
Yeah, unless it's like a previously unknown IP. Like this is a completely new thing where if I tell you the name, it's not going to mean anything to you.
Do you have the same thing with mayonnaise commercials?
Yes.
Would you like to explain?
To the point where my parents were on holiday in Scotland and they came across a unit base and they asked someone what they were filming and someone told them mayonnaise commercial. And then my dad very excitedly told me that they walked in on a mayonnaise commercial set. And I was like, that's just what they tell you.
Yeah, that's really sweet.
Yeah, I was like, oh, they saw you coming.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lie. Yeah,
it's a lie we tell the public. So you'll go, that's boring.
Yeah, so they go, oh, that's all right.
I worked on a TV show called Pennyworth, which is a Batman prequel.
Yeah.
And I knew to just say something boring. At that point, I hadn't heard of the mayo commercial thing. So I just said, oh, it's a Channel 5 thing. And most people will be like, okay, that's cool.
And then walk off.
Walk off. If they'd known it was a Batman thing, you'd get a different response.
Yeah.
And I was working with someone who said, oh yeah, we're working on like a Batman thing. He was like a junior.
Yeah.
So that's a lesson for anyone listening. Don't tell people the job you're on, especially if it's a big IP. It doesn't matter how cool you think it makes you look.
Yeah.
If I had been the person hiring him, I'd have never hired him again.
Yeah, it's
and
cool.
It's fairly harsh, but there's no upside from a senior because I'm like, that's a secret that ultimately doesn't matter that
I wouldn't have hired him again because there's so many other people I could hire.
Yes.
It wouldn't be doing it just to spite
him. Fairer. No, I didn't think you were like, and he shall burn.
I mean, it was an attitude problem as well, and that's where it stemmed from.
Yeah, it might sound cool to the public, but you're not trying to get hired again by the public.
Yes, and that's a secret. It's like, if it gets out, it's not that big a deal usually. So on some massive projects it is, but you've displayed that with one of the only secrets you have,
yes,
you are sharing it.
Yeah.
And it's...
I've worked on jobs where cast member has said something they shouldn't have said.
It's normally the cast.
And they get fired. I've worked on a job where the cast member was removed.
I will share this. I worked on Expendables 4 and there was a bar fight scene in that. And Sylvester Stallone went on, I think it was Twitter Live, to say how he was really enjoying it because it's, you know, nowadays movies have like really choreographed fight scenes and he likes just straight up guys just hitting each other and like not having all this fancy martial art. And I showed this to the head of production exec. It was someone very senior and they were like, under no circumstances do you allow the stunt team to see that Stallone is saying this.
Yeah, jeez. It normally is cast as well and they sign NDAs just the same as everyone else. And then you get like background extras being like,
"Oh,
I'm on this for the day." Like,
yeah, never post anything for socials.
Yes. Yeah. And plenty of people do, but it will never be an upside to your career. And there are people who will go, cool, can't trust you with a big project.
Yeah.
And they'll just, and as Tom said, it's sufficiently competitive that it's not that it's unforgivable. It just, there's now a separation and you'll go to the next name on the list.
Yeah.
Is there, in this vein, is there something you've seen someone in production do that was that egregious that they really shouldn't have done and it really screwed things up?
Yes.
What sort of thing can you do really wrong?
Steal the money.
Well, yeah. Other than murdering and stealing.
It was, yeah, overly sharing on social media to the point where it was a vlog of their day.
Wow.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's a bad idea.
Yeah, that's never a good idea.
Yeah.
There is no production, however small, that would ever say yes to a vlog.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so on a lesser vein, what would you say was your biggest, not necessarily biggest mistake, but what is a mistake you've made and what did you learn from it?
I don't say that I've made no mistakes because I'm sure I make loads. But
everyone in every department does.
Yeah.
Particularly when you're tired.
I've never posted on a picture on social media of anything that I've done for fear of there being like a tiny thing in the background, like, oh my God, it's that. I'm sure people are aware of things that I've been working on as I've been working on them because of...
But not necessarily in that vein. Is there anything regarding your role?
Yeah.
Did you forget to book someone's accommodation or did you book accommodation in a red light district by accident or whatever it might be?
Yes. When I was a runner, I was doing sides one night, which is the you're printing the script pages for the scenes that you're going to be filming the next day. It was very late. I was very tired. My coordinator had entrusted me to do it. So he'd left for the day because he'd probably just done like a 17 hour shift or something. And so I was the only one in the office and the printer packed in, my laptop like overheated, printed sides because it was like, you know, this was pre-COVID, so it was like you're doing sides for literally everyone on set and it was like 10 pages of sides, so it's like, you know, a decent chunk of paper. Yeah. So my laptop overheated and crashed and wouldn't turn back on. The printer was broken and wouldn't print. So I didn't print all of them. I printed about half, but they were watermarked. And it hadn't got to cast one. And it was his first day of filming.
What so did you do?
I panicked, messaged the other PA who was going to be in the morning after and be like, hey, look, like this has happened. Can you please print them as soon as you get in? I left like a post-it on his desk and I was just like, I'm going to go home. It's like midnight and I'm in again at like 8. I probably would have broken my turnaround. Can you just finish printing them? This has happened. Woke up the next day to a phone call from my supervisor being like, cast one's just sat in the makeup chair and asked for his sides and they're nowhere to be found.
Where are they?
And I was like, shit.
What happened with the other PA? They didn't?
Well, he had his makeup call was a lot earlier than the PA was going to get in. His makeup call was like 6 a.m. So there was no way, there was no way anyone was getting to them. And that was pretty bad.
So what do you think, looking back with your experience now, what would you say to Mike, your production trainee, they should do in that situation?
Mistakes happen and they're always going to happen. You're doing ridiculous hours, working really fast paced. They're going to happen. How you react to them is what matters. And I should have told anyone that would listen what happened. And I probably should have had a better laptop. But I was a runner.
Is this your personal laptop?
Yeah.
Yeah, you use personal.
Yeah. But do you get box rentals at that level or no?
Yeah, you get box, yeah. Mm.
Box rentals, for anyone, again, who doesn't know, is they give you a fee on top of your daily fee to cover the use of your personal.
Yeah, it's license. Often capped to like £500. It's like £20 a week sometimes. Mm.
25 for us.
It's probably around 25.
Clearly locations are more.
To be fair, you're more likely to damage your laptop on the fly on location.
That's true.
Than in an office. Yes. That's the fiver for you.
Thank you. It's hazard pay for the laptop.
Yeah,
I think you're right on the money about message everyone.
Yes.
Or hand write the script out.
Yeah.
And put non-watermarked ones in so that...
Yeah. I think what ended up happening was the second was just like, well, I've got mine, so these are now yours. But for a lead cast member's first day of work, not a good look.
Can you talk about, because I've suddenly realised we've made an assumption, can you talk to the audience what a first cast member and a second cast member and what that is, yes, and how that works?
So... when cast members get cast, they're normally assigned a number, and that's often how you will refer to them, just as shorthand. And it often reflects seniority and often reflects how much they appear in the show. So cast one will generally be your lead. If it's a Mission Impossible, that would be your Tom Cruise. Thankfully, it wasn't Tom Cruise's sides that I didn't print. It was someone else's. So yeah, it'll tend to reflect seniority, yeah.
And you use those numbers. So they're in the contracting stage.
Also in the contracting stage, yeah. And sometimes I think I've only just started doing cast contracts for the first time. I think often it will be negotiated as well. Like this person has to be in the top.
You don't negotiate the contracts.
No, that is normally done by casting.
You just process them.
Or the producers, yeah. I just process them.
And then to when you build a schedule for the audience's sake, you basically have the scene, you break down the scenes and then you go 1, 3, 5, and 9 are in this scene.
Yeah.
And you just list the numbers. It's a way you can see who's in what scene. So when you're organizing the schedule, you can go, okay, I can't have one in all those scenes because it just doesn't make sense logistically.
Yeah.
Or it would overwork them, or we won't have time to get the stunts ready. And
yeah.
It's just a way to, you don't have to write out Tom Cruise on everything.
Yeah, it's shorthand, but also a confidentiality thing.
Yeah, yeah, good point.
Because if you see emails, if say you're out and about and you've got your phone out and you have an email come through that says cast 3, no one knows what that is.
Everyone's like, Ian McKellen. And you're like, oh, Ian McKellen's here?
Exactly.
Like, yeah, makes sense.
Or if like a call sheet leaks or something like that. Mm.
Another question we really like to ask is, what would you say is the temperament or skill set that someone should have if they're interested in going to production?
There's definitely a personality type. Like every office that I've been in, everyone normally gets along because everyone, like I said, normally same personality type, normally like quite thick skin, hardworking. They just like get on with it. It's sort of a department where it helps if you don't expect praise, because if everything goes well, no one will say anything to you. But as soon as something goes wrong, you'll know about it. And so yeah, I think just like thick skin and just the ability to just knuckle down and get on with stuff and not take things too personally. Because people will complain at you, and often it's not your fault and you can't do anything about it. But you just got to be like, yep, that sucks. I'll try and help, but I might not be able to.
I think that's right on the money. Both in the when things are working, production is not praised, and things can be going wrong for something that was not birthed by production, but they're the one that has to deliver the baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
If someone parks their van in the wrong place and ends up with a fine or getting towed, you have to deal with the consequences of it, but you didn't park the van.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
What are the worst, I mean, I suppose this is the opposite answer, but if you had a trainee come in, they do where you'd go, this person is not going to make it.
In production, they're much the worst in the industry.
Yeah. Not having a thick skin.
yeah. Maybe like apathy or...
Needing the glamour of set.
Yes. If someone's like constantly showing that they actually aren't interested in the work or just using it for a stepping stone, because it does happen. Like people do come into a production and then they'll actually be more interested in something else. And that's absolutely fine. But then if you mentally check out and physically check out of the job you are doing, then...
And I see, and I'm from location marshalling, I'm sure you see it from production assisting as well. You get people who make a mistake because both departments are really good stepping stones to others. But it's people will come into the role and then they will try and spend the time networking with the department they're going into. And it's like, no, impress the department that hired you.
Yeah.
We will connect you with people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's natural because of how much you see as a production assistant when you first come in. You're involved in every department. It's natural to, want to network a bit. But if, you sat under the production truck on location, you're like, where's so-and-so? They've been gone for like hours and it turns out they're just on set chatting. It's not a good look.
I worked at a location marshal once who used to take 45-minute toilet breaks. Throwing that out there for our listeners. And I think, like you say, you worked really hard to get your foot in the door. Yeah. It is a really competitive industry. If you're given an opportunity, one, embrace it and work hard. But two, be aware that you've meant that someone else got denied this time. Yeah. So be grateful.
Yeah, it's a weird industry to work in because, in a normal, I don't use the word normal, but in a more typical job, you have a job interview and then you do the job for however many years.
That you want, normally.
Yeah, but with working in film and TV, you have the job interview and then you're hired and then you're almost like you're on a job interview for however long the job is because... the people that you work with, they're either going to, take you on their next job with them if they like you and they want to work with you again, or they're going to refer you to someone else because they like you and feel like you can, do the job, or they're going to not recommend you. So you have to be like affable and nice and pleasant, but also do a good job because you are essentially like under the microscope for X amount of months that you're on the job.
It's true. 100%. I don't think I've ever heard it described as a constant on a job interview, but that 100% on the money.
And it's once you're in, the best way to grow is to have people who will give you a good reference and call around for you.
Yeah.
Because I'm really curious if it's true in production, but for example, when I get a CV in location marshalling and people break down in the CV, I put up an easy up, I liaise with the public, I do. It's like, I know what happens at that grade.
Yeah.
You don't need to detail it. What matters is, this was the person who managed you. Let me call him.
Yeah.
Let me call her. What's the impression they give? And that is like 90% about if you get the job or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do I rate the person I'm going to call? As in, like, I think they have a good assessment of the people who work below them. And if they do, I don't care where you live, I don't care how long you've been in the industry, does this person rate you? I rate them, they rate you, fantastic. let's get you in.
Yeah, because I mean, often as well, you can learn things on the job. People are very keen to teach and, you know, have people learn new skills, because that's the only way that people, you know, will grow. Often, you know, sometimes jobs aren't conducive to that. Often you'll start a job and you'll hear your line managers around you be like, we need someone strong for this. It's not going to suit, you know, a first time travel and accommodation person. We've got a lot of unit moves. Yeah. We've got some, you know, abroad shoots. This isn't a job for a first time travel person.
That if someone's is made a mistake, it will cause problems on set.
Yeah, sort of. That sort of, yeah.
What would you say is an underrated skill from people who do well in productions?
I know I said it before, but yeah, diplomacy. Being able to talk to every department and actually listen to them and hear what they have to say, because it's a not, how do I phrase this? Every department is different, and I don't want to play into stereotypes, but a lot of, you know, the electrical department will be of a certain age and a certain gender and that sort of thing. And the same with hair and makeup and things like that. So you get a big cross section of different demographics. So being able to effectively communicate with each of them is a big part of it.
And a slightly controversial question.
Oh no.
In my experience, each department has a department that they think is most likely going to cause their department problems.
So you started to ask the question and it instantly popped into my head.
I'm curious, and I'm sure on all of your jobs, every department has been lovely. But on your friends who are APOC scrubs, what's the department they complain
about
the most?
That's an excellent way to frame it in a way that I can't not answer. Yeah, every department that I've ever worked with has been absolutely lovely and a joy.
Patient, understanding.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you know, filmmaking's a collaboration. So, and everyone just sort of gets that all the time.
Friends who are APOCs have experienced.
I can't say. Okay. I can't say.
It's locations, isn't it?
No, it's not.
It's producers.
No, I've been lucky to work with some really, well, all of them actually, in very generous producers who have a lot of time for lowly production staff, such as myself.
Can I say, from a producer's perspective, production are your best friends. Like, they literally are. They're the ones who take all the stuff you're grappling with, but they make it happen.
Yeah.
You pair up with a good production team. Yeah. So that makes sense. But you haven't answered the question.
I'll say off camera.
Okay. Okay. But there is one or two departments that can.
Absolutely. As soon as you started asking the question, it came into my head.
And it is literally just different departments do different things. So different departments have different abilities to make the lives easier or harder in different ways.
Yes. And sometimes you can tell from the start of the job, because you can be like, oh, well, this is a very, it's like a very costume heavy, or this is a very location heavy, or this. So you can sort of be like, well, this department's going to need some help, and they're going to be drowning at some points. And, you know, when people are drowning in work, often they, you know, flail around.
Amazing. So I think we're coming to the end of our time. I just wanted to ask a quick question on what it's like personally as a freelancer. So, as in every role on a film set, you usually move from job to job to job.
Yeah.
What's it like structuring your life around having entered the film industry, as opposed to getting some job in as a physics professor or something?
You have a lot of freedom. So, you know, when a job finishes, you don't have to do anything. You can, you know, go on holiday if you've been lucky enough to save up enough during the job. Yeah. You can go on holiday, you can chill out, you can do whatever you want, you can mentally reset and get going for the next one. The cons are, when you finish a job, that's you are unemployed, and you know, there's certain aspects of, you know, society that doesn't help, you know, when you're, you know, searching for flats or you know, trying to get a mortgage or trying to pay your rent. It's, you know, being unemployed every 6 months, you know, landlords don't tend to like that. I think it's that side of things, really, where, you know, it's nice not knowing what you're going to be doing in 8 months, but then there's the flip side of, you don't know what you're going to be doing in 8 months. So it's like, oh, can I go on holiday? I want to book a holiday because friends are going on I kind of go with them, that sort of thing.
I took some runner training when I was a teenager and at the production guild, and they said, be prepared that you will miss birthdays, christenings, weddings, you know, a lot of these big things because you might be on a job.
Yeah.
You can probably guarantee Christmas, just generally most jobs wrap up at Christmas.
That's and one of the nice things off. Is you are pretty much guaranteed a week or two off at Christmas.
So I've got one more question and then we'll see if Daniel's got one, which is what's next for you? You're working as an APOC now.
Yeah.
Is it your dream to work your way up to production manager or line producer, or what's your sort of future goals?
Well, I never thought I'd get this far, so I never actually thought too far ahead. I'm enjoying being assistant coordinator for now, as I said before, because it differs from job to job. You really get a good scope of how everything's put together. So I'm enjoying it for now. I am curious to see what I would be like as a coordinator, partly because it is so demanding and is a big sacrifice. So I am curious to see if I'd, you know, if I'd be any good, if I'd survive it. I might end up doing one job and be like, nope, this isn't for me, and look to do something else. But if it was something else, then it would probably be in film and TV, because I don't really see myself doing anything outside of this.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely for me because obviously location production works so closely, but I haven't been able to hear it from a production person's perspective before. And it's lovely to hear someone who's like, I love this industry so much, whether it's this or that, I'm going to stay in this industry.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you. Please.